Good morning, everybody. I'm going to give a ring to the singing bowl here. We'll do a minute or two of meditation according to my internal clock, and then I'll bring us out of that with a prayer, and we'll get going for our morning session. Spirit of the happy, joyous, and free, we thank you for your presence here with us this morning. We thank you for the awareness of that presence here in this moment, in our lives, and in this beautiful place that you've created for us to bring to this retreat and to bring our spirits and our love. We thank you for all of this. We thank you especially for the recognition that you are our one and only guide in this process of walking the spiritual path, that each step of the way we would be shown what our next step should be. We thank you for the love and the camaraderie that exists between the members of this group and the people at this retreat. We'd ask that love would fill our hearts and that would overflow from us into the lives of those people that we have contact with throughout this day, those people that we will help in this work and finding this spiritual way of life. Thank you, God. Welcome back, everybody. And first, I want to thank Arne for the meditation this morning. That was really, really, really amazing. And I've been to a few, not a lot, but several of these sound bath meditations. And that was superior in so many ways. That was just very, very talented. So thank you again for that. A few things this morning that I wanted to start off with. So the food here's been good. And we were talking before the meeting. The last time that I did this, we were at the Mary and Joseph Retreat Center, and it was, you know, a very, very beautiful place. But as I was reminded, the nuns there, and I hope the nuns don't ever hear this recording, I think it's quite unlikely, but the nuns there, they couldn't cook. There was just something going on there. They did not. They just, the food was, and so Luther, who was kind of running the retreat back then, and Clint, who was a mentor to a lot of people at the retreat, had made a decision. They made a decision that they were going to collect a little more money. They were going to charge a little more money, and they'd offered the nuns. They said, listen, we're concerned about the quality of the food, and so we'd like to give more money this year, and you guys buy and cook some better food for us. And so they went a little heavy on the retreat and gave the money to the nuns, and we were sitting there, and I'll never forget it. I don't know why I remember this so well, but we were eating lunch, and Clint, and as we said yesterday, you know, when we're talking about these people, don't feel if you're new and you didn't notice that you missed out on a thing, because you didn't, because they're with us and I'm bringing them here and they're with us in the group, and you can go and listen to their CDs. You can go and have it be a part of them, just the same way that Chuck Chamberlain has touched my life, and a guy that I had never met, along with several other of these these AA really great sponsors. So we're sitting there at lunch, and the nun, the head cook, comes up, and she says to Clint, because Clint was kind of the one with that had the biggest probably issue with the food, and the nun comes up to Clint and says, "Well, how's the food?" And Clint thinks about it for a minute. He just had this way with words, and he just says, and I think that's why he was such a good attorney too, because he knew exactly how to. So he turns to her and he says, "The food was promptly prepared, but it was promptly served. The food was promptly served, but it was tastelessly prepared." And this nun looks at him and says, "I'm not sure I'm following you." And he says, "The food isn't any good." And that was it. You know, and I'm just like sitting there looking at him, and I'm thinking, well, I'm glad he's talking to this nun and not me. So I don't think that's probably, I mean, this place is really amazing. So there's a passage on page 55 in the big book. And what it says, and that's what we're really trying to accomplish at this retreat. I don't want to leave anybody with the impression at this retreat that somehow coming to this retreat and talking about the steps and sharing about the steps is the same as working the steps. I just am not. I just want to make that clear. But what it does do, there's a piece on page 55 that says, if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, encourages you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, you can join us. And it goes on to say, with this attitude, you cannot fail. I mean, it's one of the biggest promises there is, that if you just if nothing else, if this retreat just cracks you open a little bit and allows you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then you can join us. So I want to do something. I should have picked up those questions in the Ask It basket. But if we could get the other microphone ready, that would be great, because I'm gonna do a couple things with the group, and we're remembering that this is being recorded, and we're being respectful that we're gonna create a good clean recording. So when you hold the mic is very close to your mouth. We're gonna need to be able to do that. So I know that Rajat wrote his prayer, his retreat prayer. And I don't know if you'd be willing to, but if you'd be willing to and read that, if not, if there's somebody else that's wrote it and willing and is ready and has, do you have it with you? Then come on up and read that. And this is a retreat prayer, but you're going to have to use the microphone because we're doing this. So, we're going to hold on there just for a second while we do that. So while we're doing that, I'm going to say something else that I made a note on here that's important to me, and that's that if you don't remember anything about this weekend, remember this, and that's that you will forget within 2 weeks. You will forget everything that was said at this retreat, unless you apply these things into your own life. That's the thing. You know, this stuff, you'll have we have a deal. I relate it to the sine curve. The sine curve is used in geometry. It's used in electrical theory. It's how alternating current electricity works. And the sine curve is just a wave. It's just a wave where you have a peak at the top and you have a valley at the bottom, and a peak at the top and a valley at the bottom. And I've always thought I have been mistaken at times that the spiritual life is this climb to the top somehow, like I'm climbing a mountain. and that when I get to the top, I'm going to be, you know, I'll be there. And one of the books that's mentioned in our big book is the varieties of religious experience by William James. And in that book, and I don't claim to be an expert on that book because it's a very, very complex book, and it was written at the turn of the century, like the turn of from into the turn to the 20th century. And so it was written a long time ago. It was a set of lectures given in Oxford, at Oxford University in England, and it's written in that kind of language from that time, so it's very complicated. But one of the things that he says in there, he believed that there was the once born, which are people that, for whatever reason, there's these people that are just born, and they ask them, and they say throughout their entire life, they always recognized the presence of God, that they always had that. They never felt like there was a time in their life where they didn't feel the awareness of the presence of God in their life, the once born. And then he said, then there's the twice born. And one of the things that he liked to do was to use the, and he says this in the beginning of his lectures, that he wants to use the most specific, extreme examples so that you're clear about what it is he's talking about. So for the twice born, William James uses the alcoholic. And he talks about the guy who is an alcoholic who has this religious convergence. And of course, you know, remembering this is 40 years before AA came into it, but William James recognized that, hey, once in a while, just like Dr. Young says, once in a while, here and there, the people have these religious experiences, and they seem to be the phenomenon. That's the way it was for William James as well, but once in a while, these alcoholics have these religious experiences. But I have thought I met these once-born people. And I'm sure they exist because William James did a lot more research on this than I ever will. But that there's these people that have these once born. I think they do exist, but I've never met one yet. And there was people that I thought were like that. That it, in other words, even of the twice born, but they had this experience where they were just always in the presence of God. They always were in awareness of the presence of God. And several of them were people that I had put on pedestals in AA and mentored. But when I talked to them about this, they said, oh my gosh, if I've given you that impression somehow, I apologize, because that's not the way it is for me. For us here in AA, it's the sine curve. The sine curve is this wave of the mountain, and when you're there on the mountaintop and you're full of gratitude, like overwhelming gratitude and overwhelming presence of God, that you just brings tears to your eyes, you can barely get up out of your seat because the weight of the experience in the moment is so great that you can barely, you know, get out of your chair. I've had those experiences. And then but then over time, and sometimes people would say the ego rebuilds itself, but there's times when you're in the lonesome valley, all the way at the bottom of that sine curve. And what happens then when you're there is you can't even recall what it was like to be in the presence of God when you're there, when you're at that low. You can't even recall what it was like to be there. And for most of us, that is the spiritual experience, this rise and fall, this rise and fall. And what I have found over time is that when I'm in those lows, in those depressions, which I get still, I have a little more confidence than I used to, and maybe a lot more, but I have this confidence that I know when I'm there, I think, oh man, something good is coming. You know, like there's a spiritual experience. It's sometimes it's a book that somebody gives me. Sometimes I'll meet somebody. Sometimes it's a brand new guy that I'll come on to at a meeting and I'll start working with. And this guy just like brings me right out of that. You know, comes knocking on the door, has nothing, took two or three buses to get to my house to spend an hour with me. He's been on the bus for 2 hours to come to my place to be, and it just, you know, the humility of that overwhelms me, and I start coming out of that. So I wanted to touch on that just so we don't give anybody the misinterpretation of what it is I'm talking about when I'm talking about the spiritual life. So if we're ready with the microphone, then we could read the prayer. Okay, please read your prayer.
I'm Rajat, grateful alcoholic. Kenny hasn't heard this before, so he's doing some step three with the outcome. Friday, April 21st, 2023, Sarah Retreat Center. God, thank you for this new perspective. The sober tools you have provided me are invaluable for this life. As I retreat here in Malibu, I am reminded of the beauty of this planet Earth. Your glowing sunlight providing energy, love, and warmth. Even at night, I can see the moon grow with your love. Your water and moisture providing all else that is needed for growth. Allow this retreat to give me humility, awareness, to a new commitment for growth and self-love. My ask of you, God, is to help me see how I can act in ways to have better relationships with others. And perhaps this comes from my own self-work and service to others in this spiritual life.
Thank you. Has anybody else got their prayer with them that they would like to get up and read? I know I talked to Sterling this morning. I know Sterling, I don't see where Sterling is, but Sterling, do you have your prayer with you?
Yeah.
So Sterling's going to come up and take the mic. I think the mic should still be on for you.
God, as I retreat this weekend, let me find rest and relief from my worldly cares. Let me find retreat from my old ideas about you, me, my disease, my recovery, and this program, and to have a new existence. Please also help me find retreat and relief from my old ideas and from needing to be the man who has all the answers for me and for my fellows, and who can be a man who shares experience.
So I hope that you'll if you're moved to do so. If not, you know, you're not missing anything by not writing the prayer. But if you do, you might have a good experience with it. And we're here at a Franciscan facility, and as people know, the prayer of Saint Francis is in our literature in the 12 and 12. They use that as an example of a way that people can begin to practice step 11 in prayer and meditation. And it's on page 99, I think, or maybe it's 100, but 99, I think. And the thing about that, I had a mentor. He just passed away last year. His name was Tim Crane, and he was a mentor of mine for many years. And he was my spiritual advisor, and he was a guy from Seattle who ended up moving. He traveled all over the world and worked with poor people, and he ended up about an hour north of Seattle. But I started working with Tim when I was about 7 years sober. Actually, it was about 5 or 6 years sober, but I'd hit a really, really rough patch in sobriety. And when I look back on that, I still, to this day, I cannot believe I got through that period of time sober. And but Tim, like Charlie last night, had taken a vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And he did that so that he could work more effectively with poor people. That was his real deal. He loved working with poor people. He loved working with people that had mental illness. Most of the time, he was a great AA member. And he was really the first guy that ever really turned me on to a lot of outside literature that I'll talk about. He was a guy that constantly was, he had a real belief that what I should be doing was continuing to grow. Like, he would always ask me, he would say, what are you working on? That was his big question. What are you working on right now? And that would be whatever material I was bringing into my contemplative meditation, what book was sitting next to me at my bedside table, these kinds of things. But he said about the prayer of St. Francis to my wife, that she was talking about the prayer of St. Francis, and he said, well, that's a great prayer, but that's St. Francis's prayer. You know, what I'm interested in is Shannon's prayer, he said to my wife. And so this writing prayers has become a part of my sobriety for a long time. And the one of the things I'm just gonna go with what's on my mind here, I guess. But Tim passed away last year in 2022, and you know, I had such a great relationship with him. He had some heart problems and ended up in the hospital. But it was just such a great thing. He'd taken these vows, and I would talk to him about that because it was so far removed from what my life was like. You know, I mean, I was during a great period of time until the last several years of my working with him. I was obsessed when I first came into AA, I met a few guys, and there was a few whispers around the hall. You know, people would say, they'd whisper, and they would say, yeah, that guy over there, you know, he was a fall down, pissing his pants wino, and now he's a millionaire, you know, and he's got this big, and he's had this huge thing, and I just thought, God, what would it be like to have that experience in Alcoholics Anonymous? What would that be like to do that? And so I spent a lot of years in AA trying to accomplish that, and I did. I was successful in that area of my life, so it was always very interesting to Tim. He never went to a single AA convention, never went to a single AA retreat. It just was not his deal at all. But he was very interested in my work and the business stuff I was doing. He was interested in the retreats and the AA work I was doing. But it just wasn't, you know, it just wasn't his deal. He was very much a one-on-one work with alcoholic guys. And I don't know how I got in with him, because he liked to work with really sick people. So I don't know why a guy like me would end up working with Tim, I had some really, really amazing experiences working with him, and he was not so much interested in the vow of chastity. That's the one that he didn't like that much. But he told me that he said that, God, I'd really like to have a girlfriend. I'd really like to have a date. I'd like to go out with somebody. But every time he'd get a date, and he would go out with somebody, and he'd tell them about this vow of poverty that he had taken, there was no second date, he found out. That people weren't interested in dating a person that was in this vow of poverty deal. But he was very much that way the whole time I knew him. He never had a television, never had a radio, never listened to the news. He just had his stack of books, and once in a while he would read the newspaper. He would do that because, you know, he could kind of pick and choose what he was going to read and what he wasn't going to read. When he passed, he was in the hospital. He'd had a really terrible heart attack that destroyed a lot of his heart, and he did live a good time after that. But I was in the hospital, and I went to visit him, and I could tell he was upset. You know, I could just tell, because all these people were coming to visit him. He had a ton of visitors, and all these people were coming to visit him, and nobody had asked him to meditate. Nobody had come and prayed with him. Nobody had come and meditated with him. They'd all come in. What are the doctors saying? What's going to happen? What's the next thing? What's going to transpire here? And I could tell. And so I found myself at a time when I could just be with Tim and there was nobody else in the room. And I said, Tim, what are you working on? And he looked at me and he said, I'm working on the Lord's Prayer. But I just can't get past those first two words. He said, you know, there's 7 billion plus people on this planet. He said, that Our Father, he told me, that's a big prayer. And so I got to be mentored by people like this and other people. And I learned a lot about what I call living the AA way of life. And living the AA way of life is... and some of this I got from my mother. My mom has been and still is a devotee of the Ram Dass. My mother got sober. She's been sober longer than I have. But although she did go to AA for a short time, her path was different. And she found her guru and she got close with Ram Dass. And as people know what that means, that he passed away a few years ago, and it was a great loss in her life. But she's still very connected to the community, and she would go to she'd been to Maui and stayed at his place and been with him and spent time with him. And so in our literature, it says that we alcoholics are undisciplined. In the 11th step. So we allow God to discipline us in this way. I still don't really particularly like that word, discipline, when it's being used in a spiritual way of life. So I asked my mom about that because I knew that she always was saying that she was a disciple. So I asked her about that. I thought, well, the core word there really is disciple, not discipline as in, you know, you're going to get a licking if you don't do right and you're going to have to pay for your sins and all of that stuff that the God that I found here in AA would had nothing to do with. And so I asked her about that. Well, what's that mean? And she said, well, it means we do certain things. There's certain prayers we do. There's certain things that we do. We gather as a group and we, you know, all of these practices that they have. And so I don't get up and say this in AA meetings because I think it's just too easy for people to misinterpret. But since we've got some time here this weekend, you know, it's okay. Is it, you know, I consider myself to be a disciple of the AA way of life. That's what that means to me. And so what does that mean? It means that upon awakening, there's some things that I attend to upon awakening, that I ask God that as we, God and I, consider our plans, I'd say, God, I'd ask that you direct my thinking, that I be free of self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives today, that please show me the way towards being helpful to the new man, that I go through a process in the morning. When I retire at night, there's a list of questions that I ask myself, and these are in the book in step 11, that when we retire at night, that when I'm in fear, there's a prayer that I say, God, please remove this fear and redirect my attention to what you would have me be. And the example of that is the last, I just do work from home now, and I work only for myself, and I have anybody working for me, and I love it. But the last position I had, I was running a very big company. I was a president and CEO of a big company. We had over 300 people working for us, and it was a major, major deal. And in that position, there would be times when we'd have some troubles, and I would be thinking, and I'd be worried about like what the accountants down in the accounting department thought of me. Like, they probably have discovered that I don't really belong here. They've probably found out that they don't, that that something is amiss here. They've probably discovered, and that's the fear. And so when I went into what God, please remove this fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be, it would come to me. Oh, I should be loving. I should be kind. I should be considerate. I should be understanding. I should be humble. I should be a servant. All of those things would come to me, and things would go much smoother when I was thinking about that than when I was thinking about the fear. It tells me that one of the things that we do when dealing with resentment, we put it on paper. We list people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry. Those are the things that make up the AA way of life, that I change from a person that's coming to AA to get something to somebody coming to AA is somebody that's there to I'm there to bring something to the party. That I'm going to come to the meeting. I'm going to look for the face of hopelessness in the meeting, and I'm going to reach my hand out to the still suffering alcoholic. So is there any questions in the Ask It basket? We're going to attend to a couple of those. Then we're going to talk about We Agnostics for a few minutes maybe, and then we're going to take a break. Our first session this morning will be a little short. We're going to try to do three sessions. So we'll do a session here this morning. We'll take a break. We'll do a second session, take a break, and then we'll do a little short session again before lunch. Okay. Okay, so we're going to do a few of these to kind of get people. And the first one, I think, is what is the definition of a spiritual way of life? I think I just talked about that, but that's the definition of a spiritual way of life in AA. That's the becoming a disciple of the AA way of life, of becoming a member in good standing of AA, means that I'm doing all of these things that I talk about. It's a practice. So the prayer and meditation, I think, is probably the key to that is prayer and meditation. So does somebody else have a something that they would like to offer? We've got the microphone if somebody else has something they'd like to offer on these questions as well. Will you tell us about the night you were hit in the face by a pool cue ball? I thought I'd told you a little bit about that. But I had gone to my mother's house, and I had gone there because I had hepatitis, and I was turning yellow, and I was incredibly, incredibly sick, and I had nowhere else to turn. And I called my mother and asked her if she would take me in, and she said no. And then I told her, "Mom, I'm really, really sick." She thought I was coming home to die. It's the only reason she let me come into the house. So. After a few weeks, I was an unwelcomed 27-year-old guest, an unwelcome hanger-on at my mother's house, living in the back bedroom of my mother's house. And any time I could get my hands on any amount of money at all, I was off to the bar. And I'd done something at a bar, talked to the wrong girl, did something at the bar, and that was actually the thing that I did wrong, was talk to the wrong girl. And I was standing there having a drink, supposedly minding my own business, and a guy came and beat me to a pulp. And I'm sure I probably, you know, looking back on it, thinking about that, I don't want to say I had it coming, but I probably had it coming. You know, I was at the just in a terrible way. So the story of that piece of my life. And the thing about it was, you'd think I'd get sober after that, and it really didn't even slow me down. You know, other than I was, you know, work, because I was able to work the doctors for some painkillers. I mean, it was like, God dang, man, you know, everybody should be so lucky to get, get beat by a pool ball, you know, the guy. And I was just, you know, I mean, it didn't slow me down for a second. And eventually, you know, I'd left my mother's house, and I was up in Seattle, and there was a guy up there, and I called him and convinced him I was sober. Told him, yeah, man, I'm totally sober. Everything's great. But I have a motorcycle that's broke down. It's at my mom's house, and I need to pick it up. Can you loan me your truck? So he agreed to loan me his pickup truck. And if there's anything I say here, I want you to know, if I forget to say that I made amends for these things, you know, ask me, I'll tell you this, the amends. But he loaned me his pickup truck. Off I went to Vancouver, Washington from Seattle in this borrowed pickup truck. I got down to my mom's. I was completely out of my mind on drugs when I got down to my mom's. And I'd been drinking, and so I get the motorcycle loaded into the back of this pickup truck. I try to get out of there as soon as I possibly can. My mom makes me sit down. She says, you got to do this for me. I just want you to sit down and watch. And she put on the movie, My Name is Bill W. And it was the most, I mean, I was tortured beyond belief, sitting there, you know, craving more, knowing I had access to more as soon as I could get out of my mom, and being sitting there to watch this 2-hour goddamn movie about Alcoholics Anonymous. And anyways, I left, and it's about a 3-hour drive from Vancouver, Washington to Seattle. And it took me about 3 days to get back, because I would get on the freeway and then I would start getting on this little paranoid trip because some of the drugs I was doing. And then I would drive off the off-ramp, and I would drive way out into these farm country in the middle of nowhere, and I'd find some place to park the truck and sit there and do drugs for a while. And then I would go get all the way back, get on the freeway, and I'd only get one or two ramps, you know, one or two exits, and then I would have to pull off again because I was sure that, you know, somebody was going to figure out and I needed more. And I got back up to Seattle, and I pull up to my friend's house, the sober guy's house, and he's like, what's going on? And I'm just like, oh, man, I just ran into some problems and had some stuff. And he said, yeah, your mom called me. And I kind of broke down, and just said, I know, I can't believe it. My mom thinks that I'm drinking again. And I just came up with that on my own, like my mom. And I was just like, it just breaks my heart for her to have to think that about me. And he's looking at this guy that's clearly completely out of his mind, that's taken 3 days to make a 3-hour trip. So there you go. And we'll do just this one, and then I'll talk about We Agnostics for a few minutes, and we'll. What do you do when you find yourself unable or unwilling to show up in life, family, service, helping others? What do you tell sponsees who are stuck? The thing that really, you know, it's interesting when I do these Q&As, which I love to do because it kind of helps. I think it helps gel the group and bring us together as a group. And there's it's the interrelated spiritual truth of being, I think, you know, would be a one way to describe it, which means that we are all together. My wife is a runner, and she loves to run, and she's done a few marathons, and she's out most days. She'll go out and put down quite a few miles. But I went to one of the events with her. I've never been really motivated to actually be in the race myself, but I've supported her and held the signs up and done things in the past. And I went to one of the very first times I ever went to one of these deals. It was like, I don't know if it was a 10K or a 15K or something. It wasn't a super long race. But, you know, I'm thinking, do I have time to go get a short stack of pancakes while she's doing, and still get back to the finish line in time? That's where my mind is at. But I waited, and I saw the first guy was there, like, it seemed like instantaneously almost. The first guy was already done. You know, he comes running down. And then I noticed that he stopped on the side, and he clapped, and he was, you know, and he just kept cheering, and then other people that finished kept cheering, and they were cheering. And these people that finished the race first were still there at the finish line, cheering on these people that were the last people to cross the line. And that's that interrelated connectedness that we have with each other is like that. It's that, you know, I can't be what I ought to be until you are what you are ought to be. And in AA, we can only go as fast as the, you know, we're only going to progress as we've got to stop and pick up these people at the end and cheer them on. So when I see guys that are stuck like this, I will usually bring them back to the first step and say, listen, you know, if you're not doing these things, you know, I've had to have that conversation with a lot of guys. If you're not doing the work, if you're not willing to write the inventory, and our book is quite clear about this, that, you know, this is about the bringing them back and trying to realize, like, do you really believe you're powerless over alcohol and your life is unmanageable? Have you really come to believe that there's a power greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity? Have you really made a decision? If not, let's go back and talk about some of those things and get you unstuck from wherever you are at. That, you know, when you're not showing up for your family, when you're not showing up for your service, you're not showing up for helping others, which is what this question is, it's usually those things. I mean, that's the piece of the question was, what would I tell my sponsees? I would tell them that. If in, you know, if there's our literature is really, really clear about this. Our literature is clear that to spend too much time on one alcoholic is to deny somebody else recovery. Some people, you know, I had to be drunk before I could be sober. And either if somebody is stuck and we can't seem to get them unstuck, that the chances are pretty good that you'll drink again if you're in that spot. That, you know, hopefully you come to a retreat like this and you find something new that helps to bring you out of that. So we kind of covered some AA way of life stuff. We covered a few questions here. I want to talk about We Agnostics for a few minutes and then we'll take a break. So When I think about Emmett Fox, who I talk about quite a bit, and it's a big part of the guys, the people that I work with. I want to be really clear. When you're a new person and you come to my house and we go down to my room and we're doing our work one-on-one, there's only one book that we're into, and that's the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what we do. But it's become customary in our group that we read a lot of outside spiritual material. And so when you think about Emmett Fox, you know, his masterpiece, he wrote a lot. Emmett Fox was a very prolific writer. He was a preacher. He would deliver sermons on Wednesdays and Sundays in New York. He had a very big congregation. When his congregation was at its fullest, they were meeting every Sunday in Madison Square Gardens, and he was packing the house. It was the biggest church in the United States at his time. And, you know, he had a very different message than a lot of the preachers, especially at his time. I mean, he was just very much kind of a AA, along the AA way of lines, and I think a lot of what's in the big book were things that were influenced in some way by, not by Emmett Fox personally, but by the type of thinking that was around at that time in the 1930s. It was going on in a lot of things. But his masterpiece was Sermon on the Mount. I mean, he wrote a lot of stuff, but he never again even touched, in my opinion, the eloquence and the perfection of what's in Sermon on the Mount. You know, all the rest of his stuff kind of pales in comparison somehow. It's real powerful. I use all of it, but that's the one. And Anthony DeMello, who I mentioned last night, he's another one. He was a very prolific writer. He wrote a lot of books. But his masterpiece was Awareness. And that was taken just like a new pair of glasses, the Chuck Chamberlain. It was taken on a retreat that Anthony did. It was somebody had taken a recording of his retreat and put it into a book format and cleaned it up, and that became Awareness. But I think that was his masterpiece. I don't think that anything that was ever written or anything he ever said or anything he ever did ever touched what he had there. When I think about people nowadays, because you know she's a political figure now, and I'm not going there at all. Believe me, we're not going to get into that. But Marianne Williamson is a very prolific writer. She's written books at least one a year for more than 25 years. I'm sure she's probably got 30 books published out there. I'm guessing somewhere in that neighborhood. But her masterpiece was A Return to Love. I mean, she never touched that book ever again. It just was her time. And so Bill Wilson was a prolific writer himself. And the big book, he never returned to anything like what he created when he did the big book. It was his masterpiece. And in the big book, the masterpiece of masterpieces is We Agnostics. It is a spiritual masterpiece, in my opinion. And I say that having read a lot of spiritual material and having studied the spiritual life and done this for many, many years, for decades now, there's never been anything written that I have found that answers that question the way that Bill tackles it. Why is it better to believe than it is to not believe? Why is that? And Bill struggles to answer that question. In the end, he says, we're at pains to tell you, why it's better to believe than not to believe. But he takes us down this road and he says, that we're limited in, and I'm paraphrasing here somebody, he says that we're limited, I'm paraphrasing probably a lot, we're limited in our capacity to understand the spiritual life, that nobody can fully define this power that we call God. Why is that, that he says we can't fully? Because we're limited in our capacity. It's like I have a new little dog that's 9 months old, a little Jack Russell Terrier. My wife works with that dog every day. It's really, really smart. It's starting to be able to do agility. She's had two other dogs that did agility where they go through the weave poles, they go over teeter-totters, they go up over, high ramps where they've got to run down a little narrow deal, and they go through jumps, and they do all this stuff. And the dog is really incredibly talented, and now we got this little nine-month-old dog in the house that's being trained, and that dog, when I tell the dog to stay, it stays. I mean, and I can walk out of the room and it will stay there. When I put its food down and tell it wait, it won't eat until we tell it to eat. It's just it's really, really amazing how a 9-month-old has learned so much. You know, this capacity that this dog has to understand and learn, But if I try to get that dog to help me with my computer problems, we got a problem because that dog is limited in its capacity. And so we are limited in our own capacity. It's arrogant for us to think that we are not in some way limited in the same way in the capacity because we only have our five senses. You know, that dog can smell things that I can't smell. It can look into the past. Its sense of smell is so good. It could walk out here and it can tell you when that fox was around the last time and when that mountain lion was here the last time and which direction it went just by putting its head up. Now, we can't sense that but we have five senses: hearing, sight, taste, touch, sound. In our five senses, we're limited in our capacity. So he uses the prosaic steel girder as an example. Prosaic meaning just everyday ordinary is what that word means. And he says, just an every ordinary piece of steel. Well, there's a lot more going on. There's these atoms swirling around at incredible speed. That it's this table isn't what it seems to be. This table is just the atoms have bonded themselves in a molecular structure that is such that it is incredibly dense, you know, incredibly. And so that it looks to us like a piece of steel, but there's a lot more going on with that. And we know that in our eyesight, we know that ultraviolet, you know, which is, I think, ultraviolet is not a discovery that's been with us a huge long time. I think less than 100 years that we know. But we know there's all this stuff going on because they've run the experiments that we can't see, but they're there, colors and all types of things that we can't see. So Bill goes in that direction. He says, you know what, the outside is not inward reality at all. It's just this picture that we have. And then he goes on to say, well, what about the people that said that, you know, that man could never fly? You know, that we were in agreement on this issue at the time, that the men of science had proven that man could never fly. The men of religion agreed on it, that mathematically it wasn't possible, that the men of science had figured this stuff out. Professor Langley, you know, who's mentioned in the book, was a Washington, D.C. guy. He was had the U.S. government had given him all of the money that you need, everything at our disposal, the smartest people in the world, and the entire Smithsonian Institute is going to work with you to, because Americans want to be the first to fly. And his machine went to the bottom of the Potomac River. And Bill uses that example. He says, hey man, the men of science said it was impossible. And the men of religion agreed with the men of science, which doesn't always happen. They said, yeah, that is impossible. Because if God meant man to fly, man would have been born with wings. And this is a privilege that's reserved for the birds. It's reserved for insects, but man is not meant to. And we shouldn't, and we hear this nonsense even today. You know, we shouldn't even be experimenting with this stuff. We shouldn't even be doing this stuff because that is starting to play God, you know, that we shouldn't be doing these things. And that's the way people felt about flying at that time, men of religion. So the men of religion, men of science are all agreed, but they forgot to tell these bicycle mechanics from the Carolinas that you can't fly. And so Bill uses that as an example that the newspapers refused to print it because they thought that there's no way that the story was made up. And then he uses the example of, well, why is that? Well, it's because of open-mindedness. That's why we're here. That's why we can make spiritual progress, because we're open-minded. And he said, that's why these guys were able to do that. He said, ask any longshoreman on the street, which is his way of saying, ask any just ordinary person. You don't have to be an educated person. Just ask an ordinary person on the street if he thinks that we are going to, and the book is written in 1938, right? And so we didn't fly until 1968 or 69, which was 69. to the moon, and they so this is 38, like 30 years before. They had no idea how they were going to do this, but they said, ask any longshoreman on the street in our book, and he'll tell you that I think they're going to do it. Do you think, the question was, do you think that man is going to explore the moon by means of a rocket ship? And people on the street would say, yeah, I think we're going to do it. We're open-minded. And then he says, well, what about these ancients, these ancient, the people that study this, anthropologists that have studied this, can tell us now that the IQ of people then was very similar to the IQ of people now. And they know this because they created the pyramids, because they did things, and they had high, super high-level mathematics, and they built incredible structures, and, you know, had built facilities in Rome that would hold, 175 to 225,000 people in these structures that they would, you know, just in, to have the mathematics and the knowledge and to build this. It says they clearly were just as smart as we are. So why didn't they figure out how to fly back then? And they said the answer is because they were fettered by superstition and fixed ideas of all kinds. Because they had a belief that, well, we have to go and cut the throat of the goat, or sometimes it was the young girl that they would throw in the volcano, or they would sacrifice to keep the gods happy. They had all of this stuff that we can't do that because our father didn't do it. It's not traditional. You know, tradition says that this is the way we do it. Our grandfather did it that way. His grandfather did it that way, and so on, and we're traditionally that way. And so I've been fettered. And so I know what that means, that it's a, you know, fettered is when they lead you into court and you've got chains on your ankles and chains on your wrists, and they put a chain around your belt and they put your wrists to your belt, and then they lead you into the courtroom and there's a bolt in the ground, and they will take your chain and chain it through that bolt, that eye bolt in the ground, and put your hands under the table. And then you're stuck, you're fettered. And then they let the judge in. And so that's the example they give us, that's what keeps us, that we're fettered by superstition and fixed ideas of all kinds. And when Bill writes this all out and says, you know, really it's this open-mindedness, this wake up, wake up, wake up. So I'm going to leave you with that. We're going to take, it's 10 o'clock. And so we're going to take a 15-minute break. Dave is going to, we're back here at 10:15 for a second session.